Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Sam, host of Open World, formerly Against the Grain. Today's going to be an off-kilter show. Rod will be showing up at some point. He's just in the middle of getting some groceries, and when he gets back, he'll be popping on. I also have a goat that appears who may be in the early stages of labor, so I may be in and out today. If Rod is here, I'll just let him keep talking while I pop out to check my goatee, and if he doesn't come, then I might end the show early this evening, so we're going to play it by ear, and we're going to see how things go, because, you know, these things like to happen when I've got a full schedule, but babies don't wait. Babies wait when they wait, and when babies show up, and that's the way it goes. So, again, before we begin, I will be popping out here or there. If Rod is on, I will continue to let him talk. If he is not here because he is not able to make it, because he got busy or anything like that, then I will just closing down the show a little early tonight, and it'll be what it'll be. So, starting off, we're going to go over some Am I the Asshole Reddit threads, because some of these look fairly interesting. I've noticed there's a lot of with kids and partners today. There's a lot usually with other things, but today there's a lot with kids and partners. So, this one posted 20 hours ago. Am I the asshole for blocking off access to my bathroom? I have a newer roommate, Mark 32. The rule of restrooms was established when he moved in. His friends have to use his restroom in his room. Mine is in the hall-like area, but I have a sliding door to my side of the house. My restroom is in my rent. Mark has been having friends crash on the couch, and I'm using my restroom overnight, and I don't know or trust these people. Finally, last week, I put a lock on my sliding door and am not letting people on my side of the house, as things like my cologne have gone missing and peeped my shower. On Tuesday, his friend took a dump on our patio because Mark locked his bedroom door and I locked up my side of the house. The other roommate and us told Mark to clean up his friend's mess. Mark got mad at me for locking people out of my side of the home because I have a hall bathroom. He goes on, he doesn't feel comfortable allowing people use his restroom at night because he likes sleep in the buff, but my restroom is off limits because sometimes my girl sleeps over and doesn't like random drunk dudes in her space. We all reminded Mark of the rules per our lease agreement, and he's acting like it's unfair for me to lock up my side of the house so his friends can't use the hall bathroom. Well, that's easy. You're not allowed to have friends over then. If you can't, you let your friends use your bathroom and they got a shit on the patio because you won't let them use your bathroom because you like to sleep stark naked, then you don't need to have friends over. Or you could move out. That's a second option. He is 32 years old and behaves like a frat boy. He needs to go ASAP, not the asshole. This, what 32-year-old has friends who would take a dump on the patio? And why is he letting people stay over if he's uncomfortable? Yeah, no kidding. Like, there's just a lot of things going on here that's like, listen, buddy, listen. Like, totally not okay. Mark is an asshole. You and other roommate have the right to tell him that he doesn't get to have others crash at your place, especially people he doesn't feel comfortable letting into his room and bathroom. And let's face it, he can put some drawers on that BS. I hope Mark cleaned up the mess, and he needs to take responsibility for his own guests. Your space is for you and your own guests. Hope it's month to month and you can just get a better roommate. Yeah. Yeah, no, I'm in complete agreement with these people. If you're going to pull over, they're your responsibility. And when there was an agreement before you even moved in that the bathroom in the hallway is off limits, and now after you've moved in with your friends, you think that you can just bend the rules like that? Nah, sorry. Mark is the asshole. You are not the asshole. Mm. Oh, this looks like a good one. So this Redditor has been labeled the asshole. So we'll have to check this out. Am I the asshole for forcing my daughter to share a birthday celebration with her twin brother? I have two kids, Paige, 14 female, Dylan, 14 male. As twins most years, they've wanted to have a joint birthday celebration, but there have been a couple years where they've decided to separate parties with different friend groups or at different locations. They tell me a few weeks before their birthday in May which thing they want to do that year. So this year, Paige told me that she and Dylan have decided they wanted to have their own parties, and she and her friends had already picked the whole theme and activities they wanted to do. I approved Paige's plan. Then I dared to later ask Dylan what he wanted to do for his birthday party. At this point, I learned that Dylan and Paige had not mutually decided that they were having separate celebrations this year, and asked Dylan about it was the first he was hearing that he was expecting to have his own party. His feelings were very hurt that Paige had cut him out without so much as talking to him about it. So I spoke to Paige, and she admitted that she and her friends had decided their own to exclude Dylan because they felt that a boy would wreck the activities they had planned. I told Paige that it wasn't okay for her to treat her brother that way, and that the party I had originally agreed to was now canceled, and that I expected her and Dylan to plan a joint birthday celebration with activities all of their friends could enjoy. Dylan is much happier with arrangement, but Paige is angry and keeps saying that I ruined her party. I'm worried that I might have made a misstep because normally I try very hard to treat my kids as individuals, not as a pair of twins. I'm worried that forcing Paige to share her birthday celebration with Dylan might send the wrong message on that front. So am I the asshole? Oh, boy. Okay, first comment. You're the asshole. I think having a mutual party should only happen if both kids want to do it. I can understand telling Paige that it was rude of her not to talk to her brother and give him a heads up that she wanted her own party, and asking to apologize, but forcing her to have a joint party is going too far. Paige should not be expected to check in with her brother about her birthday party. Did Dylan check in with Paige? Did Dylan plan anything? Sounds like OP is putting all the pressure on Paige, including expecting Paige to share her friends and include her brother. That's completely unfair on every single level. Here's an interesting comment response. She lied about Dylan being in agreement on having separate parties. True. Does that lie justify turning her birthday into a punishment? Why not ground her or take some privileges away? No one is forgetting that she lied, but OP refuses to answer any questions that may lead to why she felt the need to lie. One of the OP's comments, OP latched on very, very quickly to a Redditor's suggestion that she was not allowed to invite any of her friends to the combined party. She has nor to plan as punishment. That's why the whys are very important. Yeah, I'm really not sure how to feel about this. It's like everybody's kind of like, it feels like you're the asshole, but like, it's not a hard line that he's the asshole. If that makes sense. Because if Paige wouldn't have lied and she would have actually talked to Dylan, this wouldn't have been a big deal, but she lied. Why did she lie? Well, we didn't want a boy being there. Well, make it make sense. So, Reddit has labeled this fella the asshole. However, it's kind of a toss-up. Am I the asshole for refusing to grab whatever my wife forgets in the car? My wife can be a little forgetful in general, but she has the habit of sending me to the car to grab something that she forgets pretty much every time we go somewhere. It is usually her purse, but it has been other items as well. That happens 99% of the time. On Saturday, we went out to eat, and she left her purse in the car. I went and got it. When we got home, she forgot it in the car again. At this point, I flatly refused to do it anymore, and have stuck to it since then. Yesterday, we went to her family for dinner, which she forgot it in the car again, and I refused again. She got a bit huffy with me, but went and got it. By the end of the night, her and her sister were laying into me about it not being a big deal and how I should be willing to grab something she forgot. I don't disagree if it was occasionally, but I'm tired of doing it every time. Am I the asshole, or does she need to start remembering her stuff? ETA, to answer some common questions, she's not physically disabled in any way. She does not have ADHD. She is almost never doing anything when she asks me to go. ETA 2, we are both in mid-20s. ETA 3, why do I not remind her to grab? It is in my purse. It's not. I'm not responsible for it, and I don't think about it until I'm asked to go get it. Top comment, not the asshole. Maybe her going to the car when she forgets things will help jog her memory in the future. Response comment, yes, this is how we get our 8-year-old to remember to turn lights off, by regularly interrupting his playtime, etc., to ask him to turn it off. Takes a few times, but it builds a good habit, not the asshole. Honestly, I'm going to agree. Once in a while is fine, but when she's asking him to go get it, and she's not doing anything at all, and he refuses, it's just like, okay. Once in a while is fine. Not the asshole. At this point, it looks like she's doing it purposefully. Is this some kind of flex on her part? Bonded weaponized incompetence. There we go. It's not just men that use weaponized incompetence. It's women, too. Am I the asshole for telling my estranged parents to accept they lost their only child? Ooh, this one might be rough. My parents had my sister and I, 18 female, a year apart. My sister died a few weeks ago. I was already estranged from them. My sister was severely disabled and had a number of medical problems related to her birth. She wasn't able to eat, walk, talk, or do anything for herself. For as long as I can remember, my parents were either working or dedicating all their time to her. Anytime I wasn't perfectly behaved, perfectly independent child, I was met with anger from them. Ooh. Oh, man. This is difficult. Like when I struggled to stay awake in kindergarten because some of the machines in mine and my sister's room kept me up all night, I got a stern talk about how it was a disruption and they didn't need, or when my, how it was a disruption they didn't need, or when my teacher started to think I was dyslexic, they accused me of faking it for unwanted or attention and grounded me for several days. When I complained to my grandma about feeling unwanted, she went after them over it. I got yelled at and called a spoiled brat. I was left alone in the hospital when I got my tonsils out. When I had appendicitis, they needed to remove those too. My dad grumbled on the way home both times with how much of their time I took up. When my sister and I ended up in the hospital for 2 months at age 10, my parents left me home alone. I called grandma and she stayed with me. She also called CPS a few times over the years, but nothing changed. And when my parents found out, they were angry, and I got them into trouble with her. Holy, wow. I have so much more I could say, but there's just too much I could rant about. When I was 16, I made the decision I needed to leave, and I told them I was going. They rolled their eyes, but I moved in with Grandma, and nothing happened. So I stayed with her and still live with her today. Grandma went to sister's funeral, but I did not. I also did not speak to my parents directly after she died. Grandma did, very briefly. After the funeral was over, I guess once they realized they had nobody, they tried to reach out to me. I told them to accept they had lost their only child and to leave me alone because there was nothing they could do for me after 18 years. They were crying and angry and told me I was so cruel and my sister was dead and I'm trying to punish them for grieving the worst loss imaginable. Am I the asshole? Nope. Not the asshole. They had 18 years to realize their mistakes, and it took a death for them to see it. Good riddance to them. Move on with your life. Live it successfully. And a tribute to your grandma, the only adult figure in your life to care for you. Scream that fact from the mountaintop if you choose, regardless of how it makes your mother and father look. Response to that comment, I don't even know if they realize it now, or they just feel lonely and decided to make do with me. Regardless, it came too late and without any kind of apology too, so clearly it could never be to benefit my life in any way. I am so glad I have grandma and she gets 100% all of the credit. Yeah, grandma is the true fucking BAMF here. Grandma is the BAMF. B-A-M-F. BAMF. Not the asshole. They were crying and angry and told me I was cruel. They have been cruel to you your whole life. Effectively, they abandon you and have no right to be involved in anything that you do. OP responded, agreed, they abandoned me in every way they could without it being a legal issue. Even then, some of what they did should have been enough for me to be removed sooner. They were struggling with my sister, and I had always got that, but it was still little, and I needed my parents, and they weren't that for me. I don't know. I'm glad this kid is confident in whatever they're saying, but at the same time, so I don't know, man. It's almost like I'm getting a cockiness feeling, but at the same time, if this is all true, this kid is justified in everything that they had going on. Entirely justified through and through. So, yeah. Like, I get it. I get when you're raising a disabled child, especially one that can't walk, talk, or, like, even really eat themselves. I get that that is so incredibly difficult. And they may have even feel like they felt like they were punished. A lot of times couples that go through that kind of thing, they end up not staying together because of that kind of thing. Or when that child gets to be an adult, they more often than not ship them off to a home because, you know, it's very hard to have a child. And then for whatever reason, sometimes it's genetic or if it's a problem with the birth or things like that. I mean, generally when we have children, we think that they're going to grow up, they're going to be happy and healthy, and then when they get to be an adult or whatever, they move out, and then we can, you know, be grandparents or that kind of thing. And then when we have children, that when it becomes very obvious that it's not going to be that, it turns into a very difficult and frustrating situation because number one, you're having to deal with that on a daily basis. Number two, you don't get breaks. Number three, the only way things can really improve is if you have somebody who's qualified to take care of them. And a lot of times you need money for that too. And then there's the guilt of wanting to live your life free. But then there's also the societal guilt that you're not taking care of your child if you ship them off. There's so, I could go on for hours about the different kind of factors that are involved and how judgmental people are. But one thing is clear, that whatever was going on, they should not have taken it out on their son because their daughter was disabled. For whatever reason, however it was, they should not have taken out on their son. Absolutely not. What they did was very cruel, if what this individual says is true. And it's tough. It's tough. It's tough on absolutely everybody because they made poor decisions and they treated a child very poorly, their other child very poorly. So I'm definitely going to say not the asshole through and through. Because yeah, that's disappointing to hear. Give me one second here. It's been messaging me. On. Okay. Am I the asshole for sending my wife away and not checking up on her? My 28 male wife, 24, has been very strong bond with her family. Last month her parents moved to live with her brother in Australia, and she's been feeling very down since then. I'm definitely at fault for not making enough time for her these past few weeks due to excessive workload at my new job. This all led to constant arguments initiated by her. It started to get really suffocating and frustrating for both of us, so I asked her if for a few days she could go live at her parents' house that they've left in her care. She did not say anything but packed her stuff and left in the morning. I only wanted her to have some time alone to clear her head. I assumed she needed space and called her to ask her if she reached there safe and needs groceries since it has been a month and that house is empty. She didn't pick up my calls but sent a text later to inform me that she's there. I thought she really wants to spend this time alone, so I decided to not bother her because she's an introvert who often needs her personal space. We talked very briefly over messages a few times after that. On Tuesday, I took a day off work to go see her since it had been over a week and she didn't return or even called. got to know she's been sick for days and is on leave from work. When I asked her why she didn't inform me, she said she did not want to bother me. I took her to see a doctor, and it turned out she has jaundice and is 4 weeks pregnant. Now she is back home. I've apologized, but she's unusually reserved, and I feel like I'm the reason. My intention was only give her space and have some time alone for myself. I really loved her and never intended to hurt her at all. Am I the asshole? Top comment. So let me get this straight. Your wife expressed that you had been ignoring her. Your response to this was to send her away to live in an empty house by herself. Number three, you ignored her all week. Number four, you justified this by saying she needs space. You were doing this for her. No, you wanted space, and you're so immature and messed up that you can't even admit to it yourself. Your selfish behavior here has made your wife feel awful, humiliated, and disrespected. Not to mention you could have put her in danger because she was sick and pregnant. You are a completely self-absorbed asshole, and it doesn't seem like you respect your wife or care about what she wants at all. You're the asshole. I feel bad for your wife that she is stuck having a kid with you. Yeah, somebody responded, he basically sent her a room for misbehaving. Now she doesn't understand why she's upset. She has acute... Oh, is this the OP? Hold on. No. One of the old responders said she has acute or partial liver failure and he doesn't seem to care. Jaundice while pregnant is a very serious condition. He neglected her and then sent her away to neglect her some more. While only 4 weeks pregnant, it is even more serious. The early these conditions show, the more serious they become. Liver issues usually start showing late into the second trimester or into the third. He sounds absolutely awful. Yeah, I'm going to agree with this. Like, you wanted time away because of your job. Now you're justifying it. She needed time away. I hope she leaves him. I really do. I hope she fucking leaves him and then she goes to Australia where her parents and her brother are. At first when I was looking at this, I was just like, oh, I hope that she didn't leave. No, I hope she leaves him. So let me see if I get this right. Your wife was depressed because her parents moved. You didn't make time to help her because of work. You were fighting a lot, and how you found time to fight when you had no time to be loving and supportive is beyond me. So you kicked her out to go live in an empty house. Could have written all of this out without realizing you're the asshole is amazing. And then response, somebody had responded, worse still, she's probably experiencing morning sickness, and the fact that she's jaundiced means that her liver isn't in good condition. She could be incredibly ill, living in a house by herself with no one to check up on her, no family nearby to care for her. Somebody also pointed out, not just an empty house, but one where the absence of her parents is a constant reminder. He is definitely the asshole. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she needs to move. Lisa's ass move. Like, I hope he reads this. And I hope he fucking has some serious thoughts. I hope he has some serious thoughts about his behavior. Okay. We'll do two more and then we'll be done. Am I the asshole for taking my daughter's side? My daughter, 14, has been bugging me to buy her a pet, so a couple of weeks ago I bought her a pet rabbit. She loves it and takes it everywhere with her. The problem started when she went to her mom's house and took the rabbit with her. Apparently her half-brother is allergic to it. Two nights ago my daughter called me and asked me to bring her back home. Apparently her mom tried to convince her to return the rabbit because of her brother, and they got into an argument over this, and when she refused to let her return the rabbit, her mom asked her to send the rabbit to my home and never bring it to her home again, and my daughter told her that she will go to my home to be with her rabbit then. Yesterday, my ex called me and asked me to bring my daughter back. I told her that my daughter has refused to go there without a rabbit, so unless she will let her bring a rabbit, my daughter stays there. She thinks my daughter and I are both assholes. You're the asshole, not your daughter. You have shared custody. That means the rules in each other's house applies to only that house. You're entitled to keep the rabbit, but you cannot force your baby's mom to take in that rabbit. It feels as though you were enjoying using the rabbit to drive a wedge between you two. Did you even consult or at least give a heads up to the mom? Be an adult. Yeah, no kidding. I don't even think she knew that the son, that her son or whatever was allergic in the first place. Like, honestly, like, I didn't even think I was allergic to my rabbit until I got a rabbit and then realized I was allergic to my rabbit. But I'm keeping my rabbit because I freaking love my rabbit. And I just deal with it. But it's like, you know, I don't even think they knew. And then once it happened, because she brought the rabbit over, it wasn't a big deal until the son was allergic. I'm sure if the son was allergic, the mom wouldn't have cared. But the fact that you just sent your daughter with this rabbit without talking to her about it. And then, I don't know, this, yeah. You're the asshole. You are only allowed to get a pet for your own home, not somebody else's. You, and you aren't 18 years old, is plenty enough to understand that she can't bring her pet to the home of someone else who is allergic to it. And don't think that it isn't obvious that you are encouraging your daughter to have a tantrum about her mother's perfectly reasonable boundary. This whole thing reads like a deliberate attempt to make your ex's life more difficult. Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm going to agree with that. Am I the asshole for prioritizing my work over my partner's? This is a very pet. This is very petty, but we need some help. I work fully remotely, and my partner is hybrid. We have two desks, one with a monitor and one without. Through their job, my partner gets funding to buy home electronics like second monitors and price them out, but then never bought one. It's been nearly 6 months. They're perfectly content using mine when they're at home. I need the second monitor regularly. My laptop doesn't have a camera, so I have to take meetings from that specific desk, but they also need the second monitor for their work. Today we have overlapping meetings. We both want the desk. I said I need it. It's my second monitor for my job, and we're having a big meeting about our project funders. My partner also needs it. They have a meeting with another department. I basically said, tough luck. This is why you should have gotten our second monitor. They said, let's find a way to compromise. They're right, of course. We should find better ways to compromise in the meantime. But long term, I think they should get their own second monitor. And today, my meeting takes precedence. My boss and project partners expect me to be on my camera using the office tech they provided when I went remote. I know it's going to make my partner's life harder, but I feel, and I do feel a little harsh, so am I the asshole? Not the asshole. You're prioritizing your work. You're not prioritizing your work over your partner's. Your partner has failed to prioritize their own work for the last half year and is being pissy because you're setting a boundary today. Yeah, I'm going to agree with that one. Through and through, 110%. Given funds to buy the equipment needed. Right? If I was given money to get a home monitor so I could work with two screens, I would take that in an instant. At my last job, I brought my own monitor from home so I could be more efficient. I want to know what the fuck your partner used that money for. That's my question. If your partner was given money to buy equipment, but they haven't done that in 6 months, do they even have the money still? And if not, why? What did they spend it on? Not the asshole. If I understand this right, the equipment you are fighting over was provided by your company. You are absolutely right. And depending on your company's IT policy, you may even be violating it by letting your partner use company equipment if it's considered company equipment. Your company paid for it, then your job takes priority. Absolutely no question. This isn't even an emergency situation where your partner's monitor died at the last minute. They've simply been too lazy or whatever to get one, which is unfortunate for them, but it's not your company's problem to solve. And others have, sorry, as others have pointed out, they could easily go into the office today, too. Completely concur with that as well. So I'm popping on a Twitter from Tim Pool. Bud Light's marketing leadership undergoes shakeup after Dylan Mulvaney controversy. Alyssa Hinderscheid, who has led the brand since June, takes leave of absence and is replaced by Budweiser Global Marketing VP Todd Allen. Tim Pool posted this 55 minutes ago. Let me see. Anheuser-Busch InBev has changed marketing leadership for Bud Light in the wake of controversy over the brand sending a can to a transgender influencer, Dylan Mulvaney, with her face on it. Alyssa Hinderscheid, marketing VP for the brand since June 2022, has taken a leave of absence, the brewer confirmed, and will be replaced by Todd Allen, who was most recently Globating Marketing VP for Budweiser. Hinderscheid did not immediately respond to an email requesting comment. The brewer has also streamlined its marketing function to reduce layers that our most senior marketers are more closely connected to every aspect, adding that these steps will help us maintain focus on the things we do best. Brewing great beer for all consumers while always making a positive impact in our communities and on our country. The statement noted, we communicated some next steps with our internal teams, the wholesaler partners, adding that we made it clear that the safety and welfare of our employees and our partners is our top priority. Beer Business Daily first reported the news. Bud Light erupted in the controversy after Mulvaney showed off a Bud Light can with her face on it in an April 1st Instagram post, striking a nerve among conservatives, including musicians Travis Tritt and Kid Rock. The controversy appears to have impacted sales, with Bud Light cases down 10.7% for the week ended April 8th, according to Beer Business Daily. Hinderscheid was dragged into the controversy when remarks she had made about changing Bud Light's marketing in a podcast surfaced in news reports about Mulvaney's post. In the podcast, which was recorded before the controversy, Hinderscheid denounced Bud Light's previous marketing as fratty and out of touch and suggested the brand could use more inclusivity. Go woke, go broke. According to a statement from City Distributors, a Topeka, Kansas-based Anheuser-Busch distributor, the custom can decision circumvented the prop channels. Anheuser-Busch was silent on the matter for 2 weeks before issuing a statement on April 14th from CEO Brandon Whitworth, who wrote that we never intended to be part of the discussion that divides people. We are in the business of bringing people together over a beer. Well, you done goofed. You done goofed on that one, because you hired a woke woman who wanted to bring more inclusivity. Meanwhile, she completely obliterated your brand. This is what happens when you have get woke, go broke type of people. And it sucks to say, but guess what? If you wanted to do an inclusivity brand, you should have started your own brand or went to work for a brand that actually had inclusivity. Instead, you tried to pull that shit brand whose customer base was blue-collar working Americans, most of whom who stay silent on a lot of issues because they don't want to start shit. They just want to go do their damn job, come home, and watch their football. I'm sure a lot of them have opinions. However, out of all the people you could have hired for a sponsorship in regarding inclusivity, why didn't you hire a woman? Why didn't you hire a female who's working class for inclusive? You're going to tell me that there's no transgender people, not even one, that's working a blue-collar job? You're going to tell me there's no queer people working a blue-collar job? You're going to tell me there's no females working a blue-collar job? Not even one. it's just like it has me so messed up that your idea of inclusivity is bringing in one of the most controversial influencers right now and trying to peddle that to the completely opposite demographic of people. All I'm going to say is, like, they're lucky that they didn't try to pull this shit in some place like China or anywhere like that. Because if they would have tried to pull that shit, like, they would have got shut down. That would have been it for that. It's just absolutely wild. Give me 1 minute here, guys. I will be right back.
Paul, where is your letter of recommendation?
Peter the Corinthians hearts on my letter.
Paul, that is utter bull malarkey. Daniel 11:32-36 warned us of the one who will deceive with flatteries, saying that we are free from the law. There is a Freedomizer broadcast called Everlasting Covenant Study Free from Paul. It airs from noon to 3 p.m. Pacific, 1 to 4 Mountain, and 2 to 5 Central every Saturday. Join Rachel Hodge 3 to 6 Eastern Saturdays by calling 319-527-6208.
I will not call 319-527-6208, crafty fellow that I am. I should have caught her with trickery.
No chance, Paul. Everlasting Covenant Study Free from Paul airs noon to 3 Pacific on Saturdays.
We talk a lot about the kingdom here, and we talk a lot about what most churches are afraid to talk about or don't even know to talk about, which is what the first century church was really doing. But just talking about it is not enough. We encourage everybody to join us in their local neighborhoods, in their local communities, to find out more about what they can do to seek the kingdom of God and His righteousness. Gather with others who are already starting this road or starting to turn around and do things differently. Join us on thelivingnetwork.org or at hisholychurch.org. Go to the network links or go to preparingyou.com. Join the network there. It's all the same. And we'll try to hook you up with people in your local area. They will not be perfect. They don't walk on water. They are not necessarily saints. But they are talking about seeking the kingdom of God and His righteousness. And join us on Facebook. Facebook.com, His Holy Church, all one word. Join us there. We'll give you updates so you can start doing some studying and thinking about these things and start looking into these things for yourselves. But it's just not enough to sit and listen or to talk about or to say. You must become a doer of the word.
Hello, everybody. Sorry I had to take a quickie break. Husband is currently making poutine, and he is trying to make raw cheese curds, and it's not working. And he's making gravy, and it's not working. And so I'm just going to pop on here for a couple more minutes, just kind of finish the hour, and then I think I'm going to head out for the evening because I got to go check my goat anyway. So, yeah, this whole Dylan Mulvaney thing, it's getting to be absolutely wild. Absolutely wild. Find another Twitter post. What? Joe Biden, I make no apologies for being the most pro-union president in American history. What? Huh? Apparently Biden's fucking post got fact-checked here. On December 22nd, 2022, President Biden signed a bill to block the railroad union from striking. That's funny. That is so funny that he freaking got fact-checked. I'm not going to lie. That's pretty good. The fact that he got fact-checked is pretty good. Full news, which I feel duty beyond to share. Activists in my mentions are trying to organize yet another boycott of my work, this time for Harry Potter TV show. As forewarned is forearmed, I've taken the precaution of laying a general stock of champagne. Yeah. The Bud Light executive who came up with the Dylan Mulvaney campaign is now gone from the company. I told you this boycott was working. We got actual results. A victory for Team Sanity. Yep. Oh, snap. Age play. The next trend to be added to the LGBTQ alphabet, adult men identifying as babies. Well, I can't say that's my thing. I can't say, though, that I'm going to sit here and knock that too hard, because obviously there is some trauma or neglect that that individual went through, that they felt like they couldn't get that when they were a child, so they're trying to play that out now so that it's a fetish. If you're a consenting adult and you do that, you can do that. Just keep that in your circles. That's not exactly a flex. But you know what? Yeah. I don't think we should making those. That's a little much for me. Disclose TV. New illegal aliens who are LGBTQ may not be detained anymore under Democrats' new bill if they qualify as vulnerable persons. So, oh boy, this is going to end up bad, you guys. This is going to end up bad. The fact that there's even that potential there that they are exempt from the law based on vulnerabilities, that's not going to be good. So, oh my goodness. Okay. Well, I think I'm going to head out this evening. I've got to go check on my goat. I've got to help my husband make supper because he is making an entire meal he has never made before. And I will catch you guys again, not this next week, but the week after, because my son's birthday is going to be happening this next Friday. And this Friday after, I'm going to be trying to have Patrick Henderson on. Because he will be talking about, let me see here, Lost Horizons. Rod had been coming on this last little while talking about Lost Horizons. Actually, you know what, let me just text Rod really quick and see if he's even coming, because if he's not coming anymore tonight, then I'm going to end it. If he's going to be showing up here in the next couple minutes, then I will let him do what he does, and I will pop out and then pop back in. So just give me about 5 minutes. Oh, is that him here?
This is Rod. Hello.
Hi. I was just about to end because I didn't think you were coming. All good. Huh?
Yes, and I arrived in the nick of time.
Yeah, because I was just telling everybody that I've got to go check my goat here really quick, because she has started to lose a bit of her mucus plug here, so I've got to keep eyes on her. But, I will let you do talk about mortgage and stuff. And you know what? You know what I think would be super fun, Rod? I think you should join Freedomizer. I emailed you this, but I think you should join Freedomizer, because if you're going to be talking about these things, I think that would be an incredible thing to have a show that, like, you could talk about, like, these specific things and bring some of these guests that you've been suggesting to me onto your show as well. We could definitely be bouncing off each other on each other's shows, but I think that would be super-duper neat if you could get a show going. on Freedomizers. So you'll have to let me know your thoughts. And if you're interested in that, I can hook you up with Proof Negative, because he owns the network, and you could talk to him. Because I think that would be, because, like, on my show is pretty much the closest thing we get to talking about these kinds of things. And I know if you were talking about these kinds of things on your own show, like, you would get a lot of hits, dude. You get a lot of views. So further ado, though, I'm going to let you take off and do talk about where you picked off last time, because I've got to go hop out and check my goat. So the floor is yours, bud.
What is it that's being foreclosed? In the old days, they had a mortgage. And in about the 70s, I think it was, there was a financial crisis, and there were so many mortgages being foreclosed on, they had to go to court for that. Maybe I should step back. In the really old days, I have the impression that they could not grab the house. That if the mortgage wasn't paid, and then when grandma died, there was a mortgage, and they would go to court to foreclose on the mortgage, and they would say things like, oh, they signed the mortgage, and here's the payment schedule, and here's the way to pay. Foreclosure. And in the 70s or so, I think it started with California, they invented the deed of trust, where you actually deed your house to the creditor of the bank, or whoever is usually a bank, with power of sale to be exercised in case of default. So they do not need to go to court. They simply give you a notice of default, and then 30 days later, I think it is, they send a public auction. Normally, it used to be on the courthouse steps. I've seen them advertised for different places, and in one case, it was actually held in the office of an attorney on the 7th floor with possibly several sit-overs. Well, that doesn't sound fair, at least. I don't know if it's legal, because the point of an auction is you're supposed to get the best price. And you only get the best price if you have a number of people bidding at the auction. The bank is the only one that knows about it, and they put in their credit bid. They don't actually pay any money. They just knock it off against how much you owe them. That's if you owe more than the property's worth of the property, and they more than they buy the property for. So they will put in a bid for the amount of the indebtedness, the arrears, and if there's no higher bid, then that's what the sales price is, and there's nothing left over. That an auction that gets the best price, hopefully it would not be underwater, hopefully the price that the house sells for is more than you owe on it, and you're supposed to get. Probably does nothing but land records whenever it is a sale or a mortgage. Somebody gives a document to the county recorder. And these are all supposed to be notarized. And they are generally all notarized. Also, when there's an assignment of mortgage, when you take in a mortgage and the original mortgagee says, I want my money back right away, I'm going to sell the mortgage to somebody else. Now you're going to owe it to them. So they do that, and they're supposed to give you a notice. Your new creditor is ABC Bank. You would think the original creditor would send you the notice because they're the ones that you're listening to. Anybody in the world could show up and send you a letter and say, oh, you owe it to us now. Pay us instead of how do you know when you hear from a stranger that it's legitimate, not a scam? You don't hear from the original creditor. You're out of it, they don't care anymore. Put the money in. You hear from the new creditor saying, oh, us now. And maybe they did all their transfer paperwork right, and maybe they didn't. And that can become an issue if the new creditor wants. It's filling the whole paperwork with new paperwork. And then 60 Minutes broke a story on this where a fellow, great number of mortgages were signed with the name of Linda Green. And who is this Linda Green? 60 Minutes found the fellow and said, oh, yes, I'm Linda Green. And here's somebody else. Yes, I'm Linda Green. I'm Linda Green, too. A great many employees of StockX were called Linda Green. Well, we're using the name Linda Green. And the notary would go ahead and say, oh, yes, Linda Green signed the other one. The notary is not supposed to say anything without actually witnessing the signature. the stack of papers in the morning that was just fine, 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 fine. And like, hand over to the next cubicle, and go to the stamp, 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 stamp.
Hold on, Rod, you got really, really far away there.
I'm sorry. And for the signing agent and the notary would not know anything about the case or what they were signing, and they didn't take back the papers. You know, and they're the ones responsible because their signature. Somebody else prepared the paperwork, but we don't know who that was without going to court and getting discovery. Right. So there's the mortgage deed of trust. So if you want, if you receive a notice of default and you want to stop the sale, it's up to you to go to court. You have to say an order, money trail, correct. So you'd want to see all that. When you go to court, so you file the complaint, and then the other side has 30 days or so to file an answer. And if they want to file a counterclaim, and you have your counterclaim answer, goes back and forth. And then you get into discovery. You can have about three or four different forms of discovery. You can ask for documents. You can ask for using both depositions. You can sit somebody down with a notary or a recording and ask questions. That's kind of rare. Well, the banks do that. It's rare that a pro se litigant would do that. You have to have all your questions together. You can only get one shot at every witness. Much more common to do interrogatories and written questions, where you list generally, there's a limit of 25. Designed to narrow the controversy, so you ask questions that nobody disputes, just to exclude irrelevant areas of possible conflict. Not so much to actually win the case by asking them to admit, you know, that they don't own the loan or something like that. You can certainly ask, what do you like? So, after discovery, normally there's a motion for summary judgment. And the point of summary judgment is to say that there's no gray area. The evidence is so one-sided that one side has to win and the other side has to lose because the other side doesn't possibly have a case. Duration is simply some magic language, and I swear on a penalty of perjury that the above is true. That's sort of thing. And they skipped having literary. That was And the legislatures of the states invented that because too many lawyers were annoyed at having to run around at 5 o'clock trying to find a notary. So now we have declarations. There's in each state there's a statute that says that anywhere an affidavit can be used, a declaration can be used in its place with equal effect. Okay, to actually make you raise your hand right in the square. You can, I could do acknowledgments, which is what real estate conveyances are. Nobody swears to anything, but somebody signs it, and the notary checks the ID to make sure that they are who they say they are, and if they're signing on behalf of a corporation, they're supposed to show evidence that they have that job or that authority to sign in the office that they're occupying. Notary can also make certified copies. If you're making a document, you say, here's a letter from my grandfather, I have to make a certified copy, and it'll certify that that was in your possession. There are certain documents they're not supposed to make certified copies of, like birth certificates. Right, so we have mortgages, deeds of trust, lawsuit, and complaint, counterclaim, discovery, summary judgment. I did skip over the motion to dismiss for failure to state a claim upon which relief can be granted. When you file your complaint, particularly if you're a pro se and you don't know what you're doing, the other side will move to dismiss for failure to state a claim, or at least state a claim upon which relief can be granted, upon which the court should grant relief. In other words, you know, everything you say is true. The other side, the defendant still doesn't owe you anything because you got the law wrong or you're complaining about the wrong thing, something like that. So then there's discovery and then summary judgment. And if it makes it past summary judgment, if both sides produce evidence that they ought to win, then somebody's got to be wrong, and because basically you've got two overlapping sets of swearings of affidavits or declarations. So neither one can be right, and so it has to go to trial to find out who the liar is. No question. Traditionally, it's the jury, but if you waive jury trial, then you'll have a judge. And I forgot to say, you can go to either federal court or state court. Normally, things like this go to state court. But if there are interstate parties and more than $75,000 at stake, then you can sue in the state in federal court. That's under 1332. That's 28 U.S.C. 1332. 28, Title 28 of the United States Code defines the courts and how they work, the federal courts and how they work. So 28 U.S. Code. The U.S. Code is a reorganization of the statutes at large. Congress passes statutes every year, but they can be on any subject. And then a committee of lawyers organizes them into the statutes at the United States Code, which are published periodically. Two is the section that says that federal court has jurisdiction if there are three different defendants are citizens of different states and there is more than the value of controversy, is more than $75,000. And the value, if the house involved, the value of controversy is the value of the house. It's not just, well, you owe me $5,000 for the mortgage, but so that's the amount of controversy. No, it's the entire value of the house. I didn't mention the lien. I mentioned deeds of trust, but they have to be paid off in the order. If there's a sale, the deeds of trust will be paid off in the order that they were recorded, if there's enough money to pay them off. 20 mortgages, so that the same company would lend you both the 80% and the 20%. That's not a good practice. They like to have you risk some money so you'll bend the efforts to make sure that thing gets paid every month and you don't lose the house. So they like you to have a down payment, and they like to make sure the down payment isn't borrowed. There was a movie, The Big Short, about how these mortgages, these deeds of trust, were packaged up into securities and sold in the securities market. And each one has a different likelihood of going bad. One mortgage of this tranche is a slice, it would be a collection of these 50 or 100 or whatever of these mortgages together. If one of them goes bad, then the contract says they'll move that out of the trust and move another one in. So they have an artificially low probability of defaulting on that tranche as a whole. So the institutional investor that buys the tranche to make sure it gets their money. Well, that works unless there's it works as long as all the probabilities are independent. If there's an economic downturn that affects everybody, then all of these things, even the supposedly AAA, you know, low likelihood of going bad, they will still go bad. And that happened after the financial crisis of 2008. Did not realize that when a company files bankruptcy, if they do business in the UK or other places outside America, they cannot do any business at all unless it's overseen by the bankruptcy trustee. And so it was an inconvenience to Lehman Brothers in the States, but it was an absolute stoppage of their business in other countries. So that was much worse than expected, and so that triggered other things, other companies to fail. Any of them that you don't think happened didn't happen. After that is over, if you don't win, including appeals, which can take a while, there is an FED, that's forcible entry and unlawful detainer. FED, forcible entry and detainer, sometimes failed on as forcible entry and unlawful detainer. That is a combination of two things with different roots. Forcible entry is when someone, if someone were to invade your house and then not leave, or if someone builds a fence enclosing part of your land, your neighbor claims, you know, builds their fence on your land, the or lease. At the end of the year, they're supposed to leave or renew the lease, and they don't do either one. So they're still there. Again, you're not supposed to displace them by force. You're supposed to go to court, and that is unlawful detainer. Unlawful detainer because they're detaining the property without basis in law. And this forcible entry and unlawful detainer have been combined into one thing, one action. And then when California and other states invented the deed of trust, they also says you didn't pay. And if the bank says they own the loan, then after they give you a notice, or after they say they give you a notice, they hold an auction and they sell it to someone else or to themselves. And they declare, now they're the owner. And then they file an FED saying, you're now holding over after the expiration of the term. Well, there was no term rental agreement. Well, you weren't a tenant. Well, the legislatures have fixed this by making statutes to say what is the deed of trust and it's not paid, there was a default, then the homeowner becomes a tenant at sufferance. There's different tendencies, and tenant at sufferance means as long as we feel like letting you be there. But I've seen a case where about FED where tenancy at sufferance is not, it said it has to be a genuine tenancy with a real rental agreement, not merely the tenancy imputed by the legislature. So there's a conflict between the courts that do things traditionally, they follow tradition, and the legislature, which follows the will of the voters or the lobbyists. The banks are good lobbyists, and they really wanted this ability to kick people out without having to do the traditional. Before they applied the FED to this, they sent you a letter inviting you to join the lawsuit. And if you didn't join the lawsuit, then you get kicked out when this John Doe got kicked out. Because it had to do with a testing of title. You couldn't get possession without getting title. You couldn't prove title unless there was a contest about who's got title. Well, he was just waiting for a knock on the door from the bank, and then when the bank knocked on the door, he had to move out. And it's not quite that way. He could have stayed a lot longer if he had known all these rules. Sometimes the bank is the one that files suit. And if there's a homeowners association involved, they would file suit. Business regulation that is applicable only to automobiles that are used for competition or profit on the public highways. The basic idea is that it's unlawful to use public property for private gain, and public property is the roads, the highways. And so if you are hauling freight for hire, or if you are carrying fare-paying passengers, or if you are employed as a driver, as in Driving Miss Daisy, you may remember the movie Driving Miss Daisy, where this fellow actually got himself hired as a driver. That's what a driver is. So if you're doing one of those three things, then you're using your competency. And everybody simply assumes that everything on the road is a motor, vehicle, instead of defining a motor vehicle as commercial business entity. There's a red herring where some types of vehicles are defined as commercial. The phrase commercial motor vehicle is defined to mean something. Now, if you know about these things, when a term is defined, it no longer means what it would have meant. So you take the words commercial motor vehicle and you can, excuse me.
Yes? Yes?
for sales of duty vehicles. It simply means whatever the legislature has defined it to mean. And the legislature has defined commercial motor vehicle to be a motor vehicle of a certain size, over a certain weight limit, or any size carrying hazardous materials, as I like to phrase it, heavy or stinky. So that's what a commercial vehicle is. So the fact that there's a section for commercial motor vehicles and then there's another section for all other motor vehicles sometimes fools people into thinking, well, these other motor vehicles must have nothing to do with commerce, must have nothing to do with money, which is not the case. What we have is the entire vehicle code is a business regulation. It's all about commercial motor vehicles, other ones that are not heavy and not stinky, but they are still used for compensation or profit. And there was we don't just assume news for no reason. There was a campaign of miseducation of the public that happened nationwide to get us all fooled about this. It used to be that traffic court was only for truckers. And the legislature put together a committee to try to figure out how do we make the general public users of small cars feel welcome in traffic court, feel like they belong in traffic court. And that was called the Minor Court Rules Committee. It was illegally composed of members from different branches for the law. And this committee was made of members from different branches. So that's unconstitutional, not really. And they made recommendations to the legislature about what? Changes in the court committee? About the court rules for traffic court. So again, by the way, and then I wrote to the a lawyer at the DMV. I don't know. Lawyer is something like that. We have, at the federal level, the Freedom of Information Act, and in each state there's a similar law called the Public Records Law. And my friend wrote to the DMV under the Public Records Law and asked for a document that describes any licensing program for non-business automobiles that are not used for compensation or profit, and an application for a license to do such a program. And the answer was, this is David Ireland going back, he said, we have no such record. There's no document describing any licensing program for non-business automobiles. And there's no license application for a license for non-business automobiles and not used for compensation or profit. So you may know the idea of a control experiment. A control experiment is where you do the same thing twice with only a slight difference in conditions. And you have a different result.
Just a second.
Okay.
Your phone is really, really choppy. I don't know if it's just this on my end, but it when you first started this evening, it was like pretty clear, but now it's getting really, really choppy. I'm not sure if you have poor weather out there or what's going on. But
I did move from one room. Yes, I did move from one room to another.
Okay.
Are we good
that
now?
That might be why.
Yes. Are we good now?
Hold on. Try again.
Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you. It's less choppy now. Before it was pretty choppy.
Okay. I'm not sure how much the listeners may have missed. I may be talking too fast or too low. I may have missed it all. Who knows?
Anyway,
I was talking about a public record law request for the license, the application for a license or any document about a licensing program for non-business automobiles that are not being used for compensation or profit. So the answer was there is no such document, but we have no such document in our possession in our record. So,
we lost you there, Rod. I don't know what just happened, but it's you're not coming through at all, my brother.
All right. How are we? How is this? Is good?
Yeah, I can hear you again. And now you're quiet again. Huh. Apparently there's just all the technical difficulties this evening. Because, you know, things just can't go smooth when you need them to go smooth. They've got to make things difficult. Sunspots, yeah, that might be it. In fact, I might even head to Google after we're done this show tonight and maybe check it out, because that seems to be the wonderful thing that loves to happen whenever things start getting really weird. But yeah, I can hear you again. I don't know what was going on, but you were talking and all of a sudden it just cut off, break, dead ass silent, and then it's good again, and then dead silent again. So I don't know. Yeah, Murphy's Law, what can go wrong will go wrong, so... I can hear you again, yes, so have at it again.
I sure would like to hear what living files are like.
Sorry, what files?
Living files, because I know what dead silence sounds like. Now I want to know what living silence sounds like.
Huh.
I'm just making a way. Yes, Murphy's Law. Murphy was a car engineer, and they were working on race cars. And he made an accelerometer, which measures how fast you're accelerating, or how fast you're accelerating. And they installed it in his race car, and he went whoosh, and someone had installed it backwards. So Murphy drew the lesson from this: always design his accelerometer in such a way that it can only be installed one way. Not as a rectangle, but as a funny shape, so you can only put it in one way. Because as a designer, you should assume that if something goes wrong, that it will. Therefore, design the thing so it can't go wrong. So that is the true origin of Murphy's Law. All right, so I decided to do a control experiment because my friend had written and asked for the document to describe any licensing program for non-business automobiles that were not being used for compensation or profit, and which was told that there was no such document. The same question, only I said, Doc, give me records of a licensing program that for vehicles that are being used for compensation or profit. So just that change, R dot versus R. And they ignored me. So I did the next step. I contacted the Department of Justice and said, please enforce this request. And the answer came back, oh, the records would be so voluminous. We can't even get started with that. So that was interesting. A simple R versus R not gave us a difference in the results between we had no such documents and it would be so voluminous that we can't do anything. So it seems pretty clear that they're admitting there that the licensing program at the DMV about vehicles used for compensation or profit for business. That's not what they tell Officer Friendly. Well, Officer Friendly is trained by the Department of DPSST, the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. And they do not say one way or the other if the vehicle code is for about business vehicles. They just rely on the cops brainwashing from high school when we are told driving is a privilege. Well, that's true, because driving, as in driving this daisy, is being employed as a driver, and that is a privilege. That's what the licensing thing is all about, and that's what the government could say no to if they wanted to. It would be interesting to look into the history of these the driver's ed programs. Who set up these programs? Who decided what students would be told? The author is Xenophon Putty, Xenophon. I guess that means foreign sound. Xenophon Putty, Huddy. The Law of Automobiles. And it almost lays out an alternative reality of how things might have gone. What he saw the law as back then. It was quite a few decades ago before the scam took effect. There is some evidence of federal involvement. The federal government said if we're going to because if you're going to take our money for highway development, then you have to do certain things. And I think the driver's ed program was part of that. And there's my friend Richard has uncovered some evidence of federal involvement in the overall scam. Now there is a video about this scam called on YouTube. If you look for arresting corrupt lawyer bureaucrat, it's about the Legislature Rights Act, and there's a man whose title is Legislative Counsel. And that used to be Tom Clifford, and Richard got to know him, and now it's another fellow named Dexter Johnson. And he's the lawyer for the legislature. And his staff, first of all, drafts all the laws. So the legislature will come to him and say, I want a law to make it illegal to throw a baseball bat over your neighbor's fence on Sundays or something like that. So they'll draft the law in all the legal language on one subject instead of going through every year the legislature met. You look in this the revised statutes, which the legislative council is in charge of preparing from the actual legislature. The same guy in the same staff develops the revised statutes. And if there's any discrepancy between the revised statutes and what was actually passed, it's his fault, I would think. There's a statute about what his duties are, and one of them is to not be misleading. I would think that if it, something is misleading, then you would think he would have a duty to fix it. And so we did a survey of the sheriffs. There are 18 sheriffs. There's 36 sheriffs where I am, and there's 18 of them responded. Many of them are rural, they just didn't respond. Actually, we did two stages. We did one by email, and we had 18 responses, and we did another one by paper, and those were collected, and there was supposed to be a little standing a little bit. We couldn't have a ceremony where we opened them, and then that didn't happen because life intervened. We'll have to do that again. Anyway, 18 out of sheriff. 18, it took a while to figure out how to phrase the question. The best phrasing, I think, is do you treat business vehicles and non-business vehicles the same? And so 18 sheriffs said, oh, yes, we treat business vehicles and non-business vehicles the same. And so right there, they're admitting to a massive violation of the law, because they're supposed to be treating business vehicles as these licensed motor vehicles, which have to have the registration and plates and have to obey all the traffic lights and all that, versus conveyances used by the general public, which don't. So, Dexter controls the ORS. So, we wrote to the sheriffs, and 18 of them said, plus some major city cops said, oh yes, we treat business and vehicles and non-business vehicles the same. So then we wrote to Dexter and said, look, here's all these sheriffs saying that they treat all these things the same because they think the law is that they have to apply the vehicle code to everything on the road. And he knows or ought to know that that's not the case. And so we see he has a duty to write to these people and set them straight. Well, what about this other statute that I found? And I heard a great big silence from that. So we kind of had an idea that we ought to go visit him and use the and ask him once again to fix the situation, because we think he has a duty to do that. And if not, then we could arrest him under a statute called official misconduct in the first degree, which is when a public servant fails to perform duties that are either set out in law explicitly or clearly inherent in the nature of the office. And I would think that if he has a duty to not mangle the laws in the translation of the revised statute, then he also has a duty to clarify the situation when he apparently would go in and arrest him, and the best actually is take him across the street to the state Supreme Court, because when you you have to look at the arrest statute, the citizen's arrest statute or private person arrest statute in each particular state. But it said you take someone in front of the arrested person in front of the magistrate, judges who are county magistrates, and the Supreme Court was one of them. They're quite handy to tear across the street, because you don't have to go and appeal to anybody higher. You've got the guys who know the most about what they're doing right from the get-go. Well, that plan has kind of fallen into suspension. The guy who was going to do that got kidnapped and kept in the state hospital for a record amount of time, and they were going to inject him with a combination of drugs that had never been FDA approved or probably never been tested. And there was a hearing where the state had to prove five things, and they didn't prove a single one of them. He got a lawyer somehow who was willing to work for free. It was quite the event. They had people standing around in the hallways listening. I think it took a day or two. Yeah. That's how much work the government will do in trying to silence someone. But he's lost his enthusiasm, and nobody else has had enthusiasm about going to arrest his lawyer. Mm-hmm. That is most of what I have to say about this, because I think I had to go by several times a day, and they obviously saw the plate, and they must have screened the bait. Nobody wanted to take the bait and get into the lawsuit. And finally, after 2 years, someone who wanted the parking space complained. And then it was towed in less than 72 hours, which is illegal right there. Naturally, we sued, and the judge said that was okay. The opposing attorney said that because it got there by being moved around the corner, being moved means being operated, because they read a weird definition. They just passed another word, operate. So the judge also said that we did not have the right to use automobiles, because we asked for a declaration that we have the right to use automobiles, not for compensation or profit. Non-business automobiles was the effort. And he said, well, they do not have the right, and the vehicles are in compliance with the vehicle code, which is strange. Like, it's like saying, I don't think the restaurant code applies to my kitchen and my family, because I'm just cooking for my family. And I go to court and I say, I want to cook, because maybe some guy has been harassing me, saying, well, you're in violation of the restaurant code because you don't have a stainless steel sink. Well, I don't need a stainless steel sink because I'm not running a restaurant. You know? So and then the judge says, well, you don't have the right to cook and serve food for your family unless you're in compliance with the restaurant code. Well, am I in compliance with the restaurant code simply by? It's ambiguous, so we ought to go back to court and insist on clarification. And that was an order, and then the judgment was signed by a presiding judge who had never heard the case. And that seems weird. I don't know how legal it is, but it seems weird that someone who hadn't heard the case would be signing the judgment. So, with no conversation, it's difficult to keep track of the next thing to say. Sample complaint in court to sue the police officer who might tell me about the police. And I would have a bumper sticker with the name of the website. So, a police officer coming up behind me, if he was interested, would want to gather as much information as possible first. So go look at this website and see what I had to say, and then I'd put forth all the legal stuff, and so I wouldn't have to start from scratch trying to explain the thing. You see, if you want to teach a cop, and it's not, you didn't ask him, do you want me to teach you the law? And he didn't ask you, will you please teach me the law? So it's kind of a getting the conversation off on an odd foot by trying to tell him the law. I would start with the facts. I would actually start with a thing called the de facto officer doctrine. I would start by saying, are you properly in office? Because the de facto officer doctrine says that if you do not raise the issue of whether a public official is properly in office then upon before engaging with them, then the issue is waived. I do not like to waive anything, so I would raise that issue upon first meeting. Are you properly in office? And it doesn't matter what they say. What matters is that you raise the issue, and you can still argue it in court later on, whereas you couldn't if you hadn't said that. And then I would ask, is there an emergency? Because the statute that says they have to pull over says it's all about emergency vehicles. It says when there's an emergency, you see an emergency vehicle, you're supposed to pull over. And the idea that they're going to target you after you pull over for this emergency, that's not really there in the statutes for them to go by. So, is there an emergency? Because either you are flashing your emergency lights as if there's an emergency. And if they say, no, there's no emergency, that's a plus. And I would say, do you have any reason to believe for compensation or profit? I could be more explicit. I could say, do you have any reason to believe that I'm hauling freight for hire? Do you have any reason to believe that I'm carrying fare-paying passengers? Do you have any reason to believe that I'm employed as a driver? Given the fact that you flash your that there's no emergency, and you flash your emergency lights, and I'm not using vehicle for compensation or profit, so I guess I would say at that point, it's not my job to teach, make sure you know what the law is, but you should know that the vehicle code is a business regulation applicable only to vehicles used for compensation or profit. So, given the fact that there's no emergency, that you have no reason to believe that I'm using this vehicle for compensation or profit, that you flashed your light bar behind me, your emergency lights, that you instilled in me a fear that if I do not pull over, you're going to take some sort of adverse action, coercion, course, C-O-E-R-C-I-O-N. And not every state has a statute like that. But you could, again, according to the citizens' arrest statutes and according to tradition, you could arrest anyone who commits a felony in your presence. Treason, felony, or breach of the peace. There's a book by Charles Weissman, W-E-I-S-M-A-N, titled A Treatise on Arrest and False Imprisonment. And it doesn't quite argue what the law is now, it just compares current practice with tradition and traditional law. And it says that there's a shocking difference. For example, there was one fellow, this guy, it was in the early days of police fingerprinting, and the judge said it was shocking. It was a shocking thing to do, to fingerprint someone who had not been convicted. And now, of course, it's routine. It might still be illegal. In which case you would say, I have a contract offer. I'm going to sell my fingerprints to you for $10,000 a piece. Or you could specify $10,000 in gold a piece. And if you will accept this contract by taking my fingerprints. So then they take your prints and then you send them a bill. And then you get to have fun arguing about that. Okay. So, do you have any reason why I should not arrest you for coercion? You would think that would make them a little nervous. They might be clever enough to go back and consult their legal counsel. There is a law, there might be a law in every state, there certainly is in at least one state, that says that every school has to provide 5 years, every school, you know,
or something like that. Classes in the Constitution. And if you ask a school principal, well, we've got this class in history, that sort of covers the Constitution, and we've got this class in, you know, English, and that sort of covers the words in the Constitution or something. But they don't really do what the law requires. And I just found out that at the federal level, the George W. Bush era, 2004, there was a law that every federal agency has to have some instruction in the Constitution. And when someone is hired, they have to be given a, you know, employee package, and that has to include some material about the Constitution. It'd be interesting to know whether they do or not. You could send a Freedom of Information Act request to the to whichever federal bureau you're interested in, asking for the documents that they use to fulfill this requirement. Anyway. Where do we go from here? Well, I could talk about cancer. I'm not quite ready yet, but my father got cancer a while back, and as people do, I read a lot, and I found out what it basically is after this oxygen came along. That cell combined with another cell that could deal with oxygen and did respiration, and that's now called the mitochondria. So every cell has it within it, mitochondria. In fact, and the mitochondria have their own DNA. In fact, if you count up the amount of DNA in the cell, most of it is mitochondrial DNA. 90% or something like that is mitochondrial DNA. And the rest is the nuclear DNA that we learned about in school. And the mitochondria are passed along from the mother, so they would be present in the egg cell. And the mitochondrial DNA, it goes only from the mother, so you can trace your maternal ancestry by looking at the mitochondrial DNA. Multicellular, so instead of being every cell out for itself, we have cooperation between cells for the good of the whole. And there's a whole lot of adaptation and a whole lot of different behaviors they have to do, like not simply multiplying all the time. Should I say dividing or should I say multiply? They multiply by dividing. A cell divides in half. It's got to be mitochondria in each of the halves. The nucleus divides into, as we learned in high school, and then you have two cells. So they used to keep doing that without end, just to perpetuate themselves. And when they formed into multicellular beings, they had to stop just multiplying and dividing at will. So each cell has signals that can talk to the other cell saying, please stop dividing. The ability to heed that signal goes wrong. You know, if they become deaf and they don't hear the signal, please stop dividing, then they will start dividing and they keep dividing. So cancer is a failure of the systems that keep our cells in active as members of groups. Another thing that a cell does in response to requests from its neighbors is to die. The apoptosis or apoptosis, and there can be a number of causes. When these mitochondria get weak and dysfunctional, if there's no, you know, if there's no energy at all, then the cell will simply die. But if there's insufficient energy being produced, the nucleus will send out a signal, wake up the fermentation. The old fermentation program, and it starts fermenting that way that it could get by fermentation, by respiration. In other words, both fermentation and respiration have the same function. They take glucose in and they put ATP, adenosine triphosphate, out. And the energy really goes in and attaching that third phosphate. That's called phosphorylation. That's what the mitochondria do. They attach the final adenosine triphosphate. They attach the third phosphate, so it's now triphosphate instead of diphosphate. And that's what that's what the fuel is to do everything else in the cell. It doesn't just happen by random diffusion. Anything that needs power uses up ATP. Organs are full of passages through which things flow. Or in the brain, there's only so much room, and when the thing swells, it pushes on the brain tissue and increases the pressure, and then blood can't cut through, and then the neurons can't get their blood and can't function, and so on. So, there was a retired PhD chemist and chemical engineer named David W. Gregg, G-R-E-G-G, who did some writing. One of all cancers is the inability of a cell to generate enough energy to maintain its basic organization. And I found it on YouTube, a Dr. S-E-Y-F-R-I-E-D, saying the same thing. And he's saying that cancer is a metabolic disease, a metabolic disorder, not a nuclear disorder. He says if you do experiments, you take a cancerous cell and a normal cell, and you take out the nuclei and you swap them. You wouldn't actually swap them in the same experiment. If you move a cancerous nucleus, which has supposedly got all the bad haywire programming in it, into a normal cell, the normal cell does not become cancerous. If you move a normal nucleus into a cancer cell with a new normal mitochondria, then it's no longer cancerous. So it's definitely a mitochondrial disease. And yet the focus of cancer research is all on these oncogenes. When the gene goes wrong, then other cancerous things happen. Yeah, but the gene does that because it's calling for fermentation, because it's got a signal that says, oh, we haven't enough energy, please fire up the fermentation. And that's what you said the oncogenes are. That's Dr. S-E-Y-F-R-I-E-D. That doctor has a treatment protocol involving starving the cancer cells of glucose and glutamine. Says they need one or the other, so you need to make sure that you're not eating either one. And that alone is not enough to defeat cancer, but combined with some other things, is very powerful, says. So Dr. Gregg said he surveyed the different alternative cancer treatments, and the one that he thought was the best was cesium chloride. And the reason why, it's not because it's alkaline. You can find it classified under the name alkali metals, because if you take a piece of cesium metal or sodium or potassium or lithium or any of that column of the periodic table, take any of those and mix them with water, expose them to water, you will get a metal hydroxide. And the hydroxide, of course, is alkaline. But then if you the cesium chloride by adding hydrochloric acid, the hydrogen, of course, adds to the hydroxide to make water. Then it's no longer alkaline. So the idea, and there's a fellow named Keith Brewer that wrote a paper claiming that cesium chloride increases the pH inside a cancer cell to 8, and I don't know how he's concluding that. I haven't seen it backed up anywhere. So this Dr. Gregg, following a Russian named Al Gritsuk, says what happens is that the cesium ion enters the cancer cell, or enters any cell actually, as if it were potassium, because it's in the same column of the periodic table as potassium. It's just bigger, so it acts like a very large potassium. So it enters the cell as if it were potassium, and that's through the sodium-potassium pump, potassium exit channel, which he says is a pore in a protein. And it takes a long time to diffuse out through the cell membrane, because the cell membrane is oil-based. It's famously, oil and water do not mix, and the membrane of a cell is made of oil. So watery things can just move back and forth. And, you know, oil and water do not mix, but just about everything mixes with either water or oil. And cesium and sodium, chlorine, all that salts mix with water very easily, fast as normal cells. So because of the difference in efficiency, they have to use 20 times as much. I said they have to use 20 times as much glucose, but the method of getting glucose into the cell involves a movement of potassium. So along with moving 20 times as much glucose into the cell, the cancer cell also has to move 20 times as much potassium in and then out. And it goes in and it can't come out. So you've got now this cancer cell full of potassium, and that's going to kill the cancer cell in about four different ways. It'll, by osmotic pressure, it'll absorb water, and that causes the cell to burst. There's three other mechanisms he mentions. If you're going to use a cesium fluoride therapy, you have to watch your potassium blood level because, I just said, the potassium goes into the cancer cell, it doesn't come out. Well, that, it's got to come from somewhere, and that comes from the bloodstream. So all this potassium which you need in your bloodstream is going into the cancer cell is not coming out. You need to supplement with extra potassium. And you need to monitor your potassium and find out if you're supplementing too much or not enough. So it's very encouraging to find a mechanism of action for this alternative cancer treatment. If you say, well, crab apple, there's a crab apple in Australia that is a good cancer treatment. The only way to know is to try it. There's no, without knowing anything, we cannot say if it's plausible, if it is or isn't. It isn't an action. It's plausible. That's a more likely candidate, more promising for putting your efforts into researching. We'd rather study something that has a reason for working than study or something that we don't have, no, has a reason for working. So, of course, the FDA has not approved this. The way the FDA works, they don't test anything themselves. Someone who has money says, here's a test. We plan on this test. The FDA looks at it and he says, yes, that's a good test, or no, that's not a good test. If they say that's a good test, then whoever's got the money goes in and spends the money doing the test. And then they come back and say, oh, those results look good. We approve your drug or your treatment or whatever. I think I read somewhere that they cannot approve anything that's not a drug. I think it was Dr. Sayfield said that. And it was a problem. These treatment protocols that are not a drug, you know, eating a certain thing, all of that. He thought there was a certain drug that, and if nobody comes up with the money to do a test, no test is going to occur. And nobody is going to come up with the money for a test for anything that's not patented. So the sequence of events is first they get a patent for the thing, then they put the money into testing, they propose to the FDA and all that, they put the money into testing and get it approved, and then they can make money off their patented treatment. There's all certain kinds of things that can be patented. And only those kinds of things will ever get approved as treatments, regardless of how effective something else might be. Maybe other countries will approve, have better, less dysfunctional ways of doing things. In Ecuador, there is a spa called Atletas Salud Spa that applies the top 5 or 10, I've seen different claims in the different web pages belonging to them, the top 5 or 10 alternative treatments at the same time. And they say they have never had a death. They used to say they used cesium chloride. Recently, I looked again, and they do not say that. So maybe cesium chloride is out of favor in Ecuador. Science of getting rich, and he starts with the idea that the universe is made of thinking stuff. If we create a thought and impose a thought, then the thought will be manifest. sure he's correct about this thinking stuff, but the idea of forming a goal in your mind is certainly a good idea. If you don't know what you're after, you're not going to be able to do it. And you're supposed to hold your idea in mind while thinking, while working. So you think of what you want while working. And there are other people, I believe the book Think and Grow Rich doesn't put emphasis on working while you're thinking. It just says think of what you want and get it. A fellow named Stuart Lichtman, very interesting fellow, L-I-C-H-T-M-A-N, he majored in all the different branches of engineering at the same time at MIT, because he's basically the same thing. And for some reason he wanted to study the same thing five times, I guess. He got interested in the use of the brain and how to communicate with the unconscious. Now, Sigmund Freud and Carl Jung lived at the same time and knew each other. They were sort of competitors. Freud used the word subconscious, the subconscious mind, and Jung used the word unconscious. And Jung had the idea of a collective unconscious, as if my subconscious is talking to your subconscious. And I'm not sure that Freud had the same idea, and I'm not sure that it's correct. Anyway, again, I don't see a mechanism by which my unconscious would communicate with your unconscious. But certainly each of us has our own, and our unconscious processing. Most of what we do in a day is done sort of on autopilot or unconsciously. So the more you can, the unconscious stores look up the ceiling and bite the end of their pencil, that's when they're communicating with the unconscious, trying to think of exactly the right word. So he uses a lot of rating on the scale of 1 to 10, how do you feel about certain things? And he's interested in blockers. And a blocker is an unconscious habit pattern that served you well when you were young to keep you safe, but is now getting in your way. And basically the old fear of success or fear of things that will lead to success. So you need to resolve these blockers. And he talks about creating imaginary experiences. And he developed what he calls cybernetic transposition. And it's based on the Greek word cybernetes, which is some sort of successful experience. Maybe you just went to the store and bought a gallon of milk and brought it home. Well, that's a successful experience. So now I want to sing on stage. How do I transpose one experience to the other? Well, I'm going to walk out on stage. That's sort of like going to the store. And then I'm going to sing, which is sort of like buying milk. I just made that example off the top of my head. There's probably better examples out there, but you tailor the experience you had until it matches the experience you want to have. So it's not a matter of changing memories in the sense of fooling yourself to think something else happened. It's just a matter of creating a template for the future. And these are instructions to the unconscious of how you want things to go. And throughout the day, when things go well, you say that was a dear unconscious. That was a success. I want more of those. Or if something goes wrong, you say, dear unconscious, that was a failure. I don't want any more of those. Continual guidance. We make a great many mistakes in a day. Little accidental, what you might call accidents. You bump something you didn't mean to bump, and normally they don't cause any harm. But still, as a fellow says, as a manifestation exercise, imagine a blue feather and visualize it in detail. And, and then sort of let go of it, and after a while you'll see a blue feather. A blue feather is something that you don't see every day, but it's not like they don't exist. So I did that, and then 10 days later, I was in the dollar store walking along, and there on the floor was a blue feather. And it had fallen down from a necklace or something that was hanging on it. Blue feather necklace that was hanging on the rack, but this one feather had gotten loose. How many times in my life have I walked past the blue feather in the dollar store and not noticed? I don't know, but now I was attuned to blue feathers. If you, that's called the reticular activating system. You get your brain primed to look for a certain thing, and you'll see it everywhere. Yeah, Jim Carrey, in one of his speeches, I think it was a graduation speech, he talked about he wanted a bicycle, and then soon they won a contest and didn't want it or something. He said that things like that have happened to him over and over. He says you open the door in your mind, and then when the real door opens in the world, you walk through it. That was his formula. Decades ago, there was a fellow named Jose Silva. He was a radio repairman, and he decided to study the brain, and he wondered, since the brain is an electrical object, electrical apparatus, what if you could lower the resistance? Would you get more current going through? And, of course, it doesn't exactly work that way, but he said if you can lower the amount of tension that you have, you can relax. And he looked at the brain waves at different frequencies. You have the highest frequencies when you're awake and active, and you have the lowest frequencies when you're asleep. And in between, there's the resting, what they call REM sleep, and there's the alpha wave where your creativity is a maximum when you're in alpha. And he came up with a training program for how to relax. It's basically hypnosis. And then he got into ESP because he said he was doing some quizzes with his daughter, and the daughter answered a question he had not asked. He said, "Oh, she's read my mind." So he kind of incorporated that into his whole picture of how the brain works and what we can train for. Our topic. If I have three more topics, I can get to another talk.
How's it going over here, friend?
Your
word bank is empty.
Yeah, I ran out of words. Right, so I don't know if you've been following along or you just popped in.
I've been kind of popping in and out.
Okay.
So.
Right. So I talked about four things. I had foreclosures, and I had automobiles, and motor vehicle law, and then I had cancer, and then I had manifestation. And without conversation, it's difficult to keep up with things.
I can definitely agree with that. What kind of cancel did you go over, like remedies or just kind of like the functioning?
Well, the
cancer,
basic idea of what it is, it's a reversion to this primitive state of being, unicellular and fermentation. And there's a Dr. Seyfried, Seyfried, who's saying the same thing, that it is a failure of metabolism, it is a metabolic problem and not a nuclear DNA problem, a genetic problem. The nucleus and move it to a cancer cell, it's still cancerous. So the thing that determines whether it's cancerous or not is not the state of the nucleus. It is the state of the mitochondria. So, and he says that all these experts either do not read the research papers or do not understand them, or they don't care because that's not where the money is, or he doesn't quite say that. But he does talk about also the same thing that Dr. Grigg talked about. Dr. Grigg said that his proposed single cause of all cancers is a failure of the cell to generate enough energy to maintain its internal organization. Dr. Seyfried also says that it's all about not having enough energy. And when the cell doesn't have enough energy coming from the mitochondria because they're damaged, the mitochondria send a signal to the nucleus. We're not doing the job. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Seyfried has a treatment protocol. He says that cancer cells can eat two things. they can eat either glucose or glutamine. They need one or the other. So if you want to starve cancer cells, you need to deprive them of both glucose and glutamine. So there's a diet, you know, that does that. And he says the diet alone is not enough to beat cancer once you've got it. He recommends periodic fasting to prevent cancer. That will get rid of the cells that were going to become cancerous. They'll get eaten up and recycled.
So what of things, like we kind of had a conversation before about this, I guess, a little bit when you were explaining to me this kind of stuff before. I still haven't had a chance to actually sit down and read anything, to be honest. I have all the documents for the stuff you had sent me on the computer still. So at some point, hoping that I'll have, like, you know, 20 minutes to actually sit and read. But, like, what about, like, all these remedies? Like, you know, if all of these things kind of work with, like, cellular destruction, all this stuff, like, what are, like, remedies, like, when it comes to things like energy and things like parasitic infection and things like genetics and radiation and, like, all of these things, like, are all of these components in, like, that similar, like, with the processes of cells becoming cancerous, I guess one could say, like, because in terms of fixes from, like, my study and my experience, being involved with people who have fixed their cancer from doing things, everything from like meditation to chemotherapy to herbalism, things like that, would that same structure still be the same regardless of where the cancer came from? Energy healing and then sound healing and then herbalism and deparasiting and like all these other things, would that still remain the same, or is there possible disparities in there that could essentially like kind of put a little bit of a dent in that theory? What are your thoughts?
Right. When you say where the cancer came from, you might be saying which kind of cell, was it a liver cell, was it a brain cell, was it a fat cell, or you might be saying what kind of cause it was, whether it was asbestos or whether it was radiation or whether it was, you know, a burn. But the basic answer is yes. The cancer cell is no longer differentiated. It's no longer a liver cell or a, you know, a brain cell or that. It's just a cancer cell. So they all sort of go backwards. There was a theory, I think it was a Scottish doctor, had a theory that decades ago that cancer cell was a reversion to the womb, the zygote. What we used to be before we were a fully formed creature. It's really a reversion farther than that. So, but it loses, you know, its civilization, its ability to cooperate with other cells and all the things that makes it a particular kind of cell. So, yes, mm-hmm. All cancers are basically the same. That doesn't mean, you know, some of them are located. Dr. Siegfried also says when it metastasizes, try to eat it up and instead getting absorbed. These macrophages, so you get multiple nucleus or something, and he says that's the thing that can travel. Dr. Gregg simply thought that all cells can naturally travel, that a piece of your liver can fall away and move to your lung and then it becomes a lung cell. I don't know about that, but this other one sounds more plausible, that you have these white blood cells trying to eat the cancer cell, and instead it's like one of those horror movies where it just gets absorbed in one of this horrible living thing. And that's what metastasizes. Okay. So some cancers are located like a BCC. If you have to have some kind of cancer, pick BCC, basal cell carcinoma, because it's so high up in the skin, it doesn't have access to the bloodstream to travel. They don't metastasize. What I read, that's what my father had. The doctor didn't tell him that this thing is not fatal even if untreated. It is disfiguring but not fatal. Forgot to tell him that. He just said, you've got cancer here. Go see the surgeon. So if it's, you know, on the skin, you can burn it off. Which if it's a leukemia, if it's in the blood, obviously you can't do that. So different treatments from that point of view. But from a chemical point of view, no, the treatment would not be any different. I don't think so. or taking antiparasitics. Yep. There's somebody who says that cancer is a fungus, and that's certainly not correct, but bear in mind everything's happening all at once. Fungus lives on dead things. They don't, you know, they're not plant eaters, they're not meat eaters, they're dead thing eaters. So if in a compost pile you'll get yeast first or mold or mildew or something, and these fungus have tendrils that they have these little fingers that stick tie into the cells and get the nutrients out. So they live on dead things, and so we have yeast in our bodies. And probably we've got a little bit of mold, a little bit of mildew, a little bit of everything, because it's in the air. We inhale it, spores and stuff. So it's no surprise. Oh, another thing, chemicals that cause blood vessels to grow towards them, or possibly they irritate their neighboring cells, or they keep putting out acid waste products. And maybe the neighboring cells say, oh, we can't breathe, we haven't got enough blood. And maybe the neighboring cells put out signals to draw blood vessels. But a tumor itself has no internal structure. So it doesn't have any blood vessels in it. So the inside of the tumor dies, and the living part of the cancer is around the outside, which doesn't, it might not be a neat spherical baseball shape. It might have fingers and things, so you can't easily just cut it out. That's why it's always a question, did you get it all? Because it's not a neat shape. It's all these fingers. So no internal structure. So it's dead on the inside. Well, if you've got things in the body that eat dead things, they'd be very happy to land on this thing, to make their way to this thing and go inside and start eating. And so it's no surprise to me if you mention that.
Wait, did you just say cancer wasn't a fungus? Wait, back up.
Right.
Am I getting
correct.
Confused?
All right, I'm sorry. Cancer is what I said it was in the first place. It's a reversion of a cell to a primitive state.
Okay,
the mitochondria
don't
work and it's doing fermentation. Yeah.
Okay.
We were never a fungus. I'm saying that if there is a fungus in your body, it could be drawn to the cancer cell and start eating it to the dead part. The inside of a tumor is dead. It's dead cancer cells because they suffocate. So then you'll find fungus inside a tumor just because it's opportunistic and came along and ate. Right?
Mm-hmm.
So you're no longer confused. So cancer is not a fungus. Some people say that it is, and they can get some experimental reports. They can find some support on that by pointing to tumors and saying, look, there's fungus in here. But that's not fundamentally what it is.
Hmm.
And HPV also. So you're asking about different treatments.
But
and are all cancers the same?
Virus that causes cancer, I've been told, I mean, I haven't actually studied any of it yet, so my claims are unfounded with any proof. However, I've been told multiple times that a virus has never been isolated.
Any virus whatsoever? No, that's not correct. There was, I think I know what you're talking about. There was
a report. Social contagion or something. There's a book that people were saying that a virus has never been isolated. It's just like terrain theory and bacteria and fungi and things like that. Anyway, I cut you off.
Said an isolate of the virus is not available to us. So. And I thought that meant that it wasn't available to that particular research team, you know, supply and demand. Everybody wants some of this, and there's only so much to go around. And if you're not on a waiting list, you don't have it. So it's not available to you. I thought that's what they were saying. And some other people read that to say that it's not available to anyone on the entire Earth. It's not the same.
I remember I was, what the fuck news station was it? like in terms of just like COVID altogether, because like what I was saying, like with the whole a virus has never been isolated, people were saying that's for all viruses. Whether or not that's correct, I don't know. Like I said, I haven't done any sort of research into that at this current time. I do plan to, just at this time I haven't. But with COVID, I remember at the beginning of that with, I was watching, maybe it was ABC News or MSNBC or whatever it was, but like there was a lady that had one of the doctors or something on from China. She was doing an interview with them, and he was actually laughing on the screen saying the COVID's never been isolated. So how do they have these vaccines?
Yeah, they must have got... of course, what they have is not literally a vaccine. What they have is a vaccine factory, or is instructions to your body to create a vaccine factory. Tobacco mosaic virus has been pretty well studied, and it'd be hard to say it doesn't exist. There may be a book. I think someone talked about a book that says that no virus has ever been isolated. There may be a book like that.
I think it's called The Contagion Theory. You know what? Let me Google it really quick. I think that's what it's called. Contagion Theory book. Is that what it's called? The Truth About Contagion. Exploring Theories of How Disease Spreads. I think that's the one. Yeah, it was originally published February 22nd, 2021. I'll send that one to you.
Okay. Well, I know from personal experience that whenever I go to a movie theater and I don't wear a hat, I get cold, and then my nose, you know, I catch to all appearances a virus, and I'm sick for a few days. And, you know, when I went away to college, I had a top bunk, which is right under an air vent, and it was dry air, and my nose got kind of dry. In college in September, everybody comes from wherever they are, and they bring their diseases with them. And so everybody gets a cold in September, you know, in college. Dean came in. Everybody in town gets sick. So... you know, all of that is certainly consistent with this virus theory. I don't know what else it might have been. I don't think it was the evil eye. You know.
From what I was told by people who think that viruses don't exist is that it's like some sort of like your body builds up with toxins, and then when it's going to detox, it gets a signal to detox, and then if you're around other people who are also full of toxins, they get like an electromagnetic or whatever signal to also like these, not prions, but some, you shed something off that like sends signals to other people that it's time to detox as well. And that's why some people don't get sick is if they're not full of whatever toxins or whatever that's not supposed to be there, that they don't really get sick as compared to other people. So I don't know if that's in this book, though. Like, I'm sending you this book. I don't know if that particular information is in this book. That's just the theory that I've been hearing from people. And it sounds really interesting. Again, I have to look further into it. But I think that might be a theory that you might find interesting as well, that you might want to look into. Not saying it's true, but it sounds interesting.
Yeah. Well, that may well happen, and it doesn't prove that viruses don't exist. They may have both, you know. The evidence of viruses is not just like things like my own personal experience getting sick, but you know, we have good microscopes nowadays, and you can look inside the cell and see. It requires an electron microscope to see a virus because it's smaller than a wavelength of light. But people have done that, and it's not just a little bit; they've done a lot. I read that a quart of seawater has, I don't know, a gazillion viruses. Different. Everything, every kind of living thing has viruses that prey on it. Don't exist at all. You could argue about what role they have in disease. And you know, if I do wear my hat to a theater, then I don't get sick. So maybe I have a hat theory of disease, right? Causation. Wear a hat. Don't get sick. Don't wear a hat, get sick. So here's hats cause disease. Evidence of the hat causes disease. Well, no. obviously it's sort of true, but there's more to it than that. Right? Mm. Imitating Strongheart. He was a military dog, very smart dog, very well trained. Mm-hmm. And so he made a bunch of movies, and then he died of cancer, which got started when one of these hot movie satellites fell and hit him and burned him. And then where the burn was, he developed cancer. So that burn, or the healing process after the burn, triggered the sequence of events that caused some cells to become cancerous. Mice, they do experiments on mice, they'll paint a substance onto the mouse's ear. There's a gazillion different substances. So which ones cause cancer? So put them on a mouse's ears and see what happens. And they would also tag the mice to keep track of them, which was which. And they would tag it in the same ear where they painted the stuff on. And they discovered that sometimes for the tag. So again, either the cut or the healing process plus the chemical caused a cell to become cancerous. So, and asbestos causes cancer. And if you, there's two kinds. There's straight fiber and curly fiber. And the straight fiber is more the problem. And under a microscope, we can see this pointed piece of stone basically poking into the cell and damaging it. So there's mechanical damage, and asbestos causes cancer. So we can actually see under the microscope how that happens, sort of. Mm-hmm. So there's different ways of injuring a cell. All the irritation caused by, the damage caused by a virus can do that also. I haven't heard anyone saying that bacteria can cause cancer. I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, and that's where I'm just like, okay, like, you know, like parasites could cause cancer from like the constant inflammation or something. So like kind of wondering, mm-hmm. like, yeah, that's the same thing. But yeah, you already explained that, so.
Quite possible. Yeah. Yeah, Dr. Seyfried mentioned anti-parasitic medication, and he said that parasites are often connected. And, yeah,
is that why they're saying that ivermectin is working for things like cancer?
Yes.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
He mentioned something like that. Yeah. Well, I mean, I don't know. You'd have to again. I refer you to Dr. Seyfried.
Yeah.
There may be other. You know, it depends on how it works. There may be other mechanisms, other ways that it helps.
Mm-hmm.
I just read about lidocaine. Lidocaine, you know, is famously as an anesthetic, but it does a lot of things, and it also has an anti-cancer effect.
Okay, then. Huh.
So, yeah. Dr. Thomas Seyfried here, he's got one that says lesser known causes of cancer. I think this is where the Empowering Neurologist, episode 43, by David mm-hmm. Perlmutter, MD. I think that's where he talks about ivermectin on one of those.
Hmm. Yeah, I'm definitely going to have to try to make... Got to get all my stuff together, and I got to finish getting a bunch of stuff done here, and then I'm going to be sitting down and doing some serious me time research, because, yeah, this is stuff that's, like, the answer to a lot of things that I really need to get into, and...
Good.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. One thing, I talked a little about Stuart Lichtman and his cybernetic transposition, his method of communicating with the unconscious and taking memories and changing them, not for the purpose of lying to yourself about what happened, but as instructions to your unconscious about how you want things to be. You might take a story that ended badly, some episode that ended badly, and change it so it ended well. Or you might take a story of success where you just went to the store and got some milk and came back. Well, that's a success. Now I'm going to transpose that into some other thing I want to do by changing the memory in certain ways. So he also talked about near-death experiences. He had I think he died for a period of time, and then he said after that he had the sensation there was a part where he could put things in like a portal to the unconscious. So he has some idea of how he think wants things to be, and then he wraps it in white light and he puts it into this inner anchor point. You could have, you know, that sort of gimmick is just a method is to communicating the unconscious, because the unconscious communicates in the language of symbolism. So if you symbolize, if you have, you can imagine a door. Okay, you open the door and that's my unconscious, and I put messages through there. Whatever. It focuses your attention. So near-death experiences. So he wants us all to have a near-death experience, and he does that by saying, okay, imagine you're going to die 1 year from now. Or maybe he puts it the other way. It's now 1 year from the end of your life. You know, how are things going to be? And now it's 1 month away, and now it's 1 day away, and so forth. And, of course, it's frightening. But when people have purpose in life, because now they're conscious, there's only so much left, and they want to be serious about getting the most done with them. And Elon Musk, you may notice, had a near-death experience when he went on vacation back to his home in South Africa, and he caught malaria and nearly died from that. Mm-hmm. And his wife said that he's built like a tank, emotionally, I suppose, very emotionally tough. I think he's emotionally tough because he said his father was a terrible human being and quite abusive and did everything that you could imagine anyone doing in a way of abuse. So if that's true, he must have learned emotional toughness from that, which is very handy in the business world. Very handy in the business world to be emotionally tough. You can have people taking advantage of you. You know, contending with the forces of nature when your rockets keep crashing, you got to inspire your company to keep going anyway.
Mm.
So, and everybody.
Ben, speaking about emotionally tough, did you see that interview the other day that, like, apparently, like, Elon Musk, there was a CBC, I think a CBC news reporter, and he was, like, going to ask Elon Musk if he could do an interview, and he was like, okay, let's do an interview right now, and Elon Musk just crushed this guy?
Uh-huh.
You didn't see that, did you?
No, I didn't. What sense did he crush him?
Sorry, what?
In what sense did he crush the fellow? The interviewer?
Dude kept asking him questions like how do I explain this? You know what? I'm gonna have to find the link. Hold on. Elon Musk, CBC interview. Elon Musk owned the CBC. I'll send you a couple links. But, like, this guy was just, like, asking silly, like, nonsensical questions, like, about, like, the policies of Twitter and all this other stuff. And, like, Elon Musk was just like, what? Like, provide one example of, like, hate speech. I think it was about, like, hate speech and stuff. Because, like, this guy was talking about... Hold on.
Well, I'm sure he has a lot of dealing with the public, and he has an enormous amount of practice in dealing with stupid people, because most of us are.
I'll send you this interview, because I kind of briefly went over it, but I'm going to finish watching it here. Now that you've reminded me, I wanted to finish watching it, because it was just absolutely wild. A friend of mine called me, and he told me about that, and I was like, whoa, holy crap. That's kind of funny. And you were talking about, like, Elon Musk having a thick skin, and it's just like, man, yeah, like, that just totally reminded me of that. Anyway, continue.
Mm. Okay, yeah, here's the BBC six things we learned from Elon Musk interview, April 12th. Defended how he runs Twitter in a rare and wide-ranging interview with the BBC. Question for nearly an hour. Elon Musk ignored BBC reporters' call to end the interview, kept talking. Talked for an extra 30 minutes and took questions from Twitter users, despite being told the interview was over. Okay. Yeah. You know, there's a whole lot of conflict in the whole Twitter thing.
Mm-hmm.
He did say once that he makes all decisions by one criterion: do they help us get to Mars sooner? And so you could argue, well, Starlink, of course, makes money, but also it's preparation for there's going to be a Starlink on Mars, no doubt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we got to underground to avoid all the solar radiation, all the cosmic rays, which I think Some of them come from the sun and some of them come from the middle of the galaxy because of the rotating magnetic field, if you care. So there's radiation which would cause cancer if you were exposed to it for very long. Now, there was a Russian astronaut, a cosmonaut, who was up there for, I think it was it 18 months? I think it was 18 months. And he didn't get cancer. So it's, you know, take that for what it's worth.
He did or he did not?
No, he did not. Research reactor, not a big one. But we had to wipe our feet on the special sticky pad on the way out, and we had to go past a meter to make sure we hadn't picked up anything radioactive. But we were exposed to some radioactivity, so I made... he said, and you'll carry it around for the rest of your life because it's cumulative. So I got a little bit of damage out of that. My father went to high school in Arizona, and he worked on Operation Castle, and they blew up a couple of islands in the Marshall Islands, just testing nukes after the war. And when he got his skin cancer, he blamed it on the bomb. I suspect it was more due to the sunlight cancer. American men get skin cancer more on their left arm than the right arm, but British men get skin cancer more on their right arm than the left arm. Whereas for women, it's the opposite. And why would that be?
Driver's side and passenger side.
Exactly. Exactly. So there's some evidence that sunlight can cause skin cancer, or can at least contribute to skin cancer. It may not be the only cause. It may be combined with other things. But smoking is the biggest cause of cancer. I think he said 25% of cancers are caused by tobacco. And it's not just lung cancer. Cervical cancer also is caused by smoking your cervix. Well, actually, you do, because you get smoke into your bloodstream, and from your bloodstream it goes everywhere. So the cervix is particularly sensitive to those chemicals for whatever reason. Cells that reproduce rapidly can go wrong more often. They have more opportunities to go wrong, and so they tend more to become cancerous, I think. And maybe that's true in the cervix. There's more, I don't know, there's maybe there's more lining being replaced or something. I don't know. So it's not as simple as the lung as your tobacco only affects the lungs and nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
I know somebody who got cancer, and first of all, she had cervical cancer, which might have been caused by HPV. It often is. And she did the chemo radiation thing, and then she got lung cancer. She would not quit smoking. Even after having one form of cancer, she would not quit smoking. And then she got lung cancer, and I think she would just rather have her cigarettes than have a future life, just enjoy the moment. So she did that. And, that did not end well.
No, I can't imagine it did.
No.
Dun, 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 dun. Oh.
Well, we have 9 minutes.
Mm-hmm. You betcha. Just popping over to Twitter really quick, because I actually pulled up some of these Elon Musk interviews that he just had with Tucker Carlson the other day. So after we get off this, I'm actually going to check out some of these. Because, like, see, here's what's tripping me out. Talking about Elon Musk again, just, like, quick before we go. Have you been kind of following along with, like, what he's saying that, like, you know, AI, because, like, what he was saying, like, I just pulled this video up, but I'm not watching it right now, but Elon Musk tells Tucker potential dangers of hyper-intelligent AI.
He's been talking about that for quite a while. I mean, obviously, AI is not just going to walk around owned by somebody. You know, we have to look at the totality of society now. We're all...
Hold on, you're kind of far away. Speak up.
Right. We're all at each other's throats. Every class and gang of society, you know, it's rich against poor, against us versus them, against foreigner versus, you know. And so somebody's going to own the AI, and it's not going to be me. It's going to be somebody rich. And so what are they going to use it for? Spying maybe. Maybe they can figure out what I'm planning to do because I said this over here and I said that over there and they put it all together. You know, maybe something as simple as I'm planning to buy a house and they figure that out. And I don't know. I haven't heard him say that it's an amplifier of the power of one part of society against others. He just talks about us, you know, as being a unit, and then AI as being another thing, which is seems like a huge omission. So yeah, he seemed to think it's going to be a sort of self-operating thing. Well, maybe if it has access to the internet and it can figure out its own password, defeat whatever security measures we. That seems to be his picture. That is, the AI is one thing, the rest of us are something else. And I think that he's missing a lot by not talking about AI helping one.
Well, he was talking about apparently that Elon Musk tells Tucker his plans to create a Truth GPT AI platform. I'm actually curious to check this out because I kind of want to know what's this about. Because we have like ChatGPT, and I've piddled around with that, and like. I've been using it for like research and stuff because I really like that ChatGPT. It's like it won't give you the resources itself, but if you're looking for something, it'll give you like some information that'll help you be able to actually go to a place on the internet and be able to find this kind of stuff. So I'm kind of curious to know what he means by this Truth GPT and what that's going to look like. Because like, who's Truth? who's true?
Because
ChatGPT is, based off the internet as is, which is full of a lot of nonsense. But like, who's true? Anyway, back to you.
And not only that, but it's not very good at accuracy. I asked it which Montana statutes say it's okay, or which Montana law says it's okay to sign a document as an agent of someone else, and with this formula, one name by another name agent. And they quoted a statute to me that had the exact language that I used. I said, great. So I looked it up, and that's not what it said. 123.456, and I looked it up, it's something else entirely. I said, okay, well, this is what I find. And it says, I apologize for the confusion. And it gave me something else, and that wasn't right either. Oh, I apologize for the confusion. I said, okay, give me a link, and I'll give you a link, and then it's something else. So it's not very good at accuracy.
No.
And I think when someone found out a famous example of that and broadcast it, the stock of whoever OpenAI went down because they were realizing it wasn't what they thought it was. It's very good at imitating styles. If you want to say, write me a poem, write me another Beatles song. Write me a Beatles song about avocados. Now make it darker, and it'll do all that. It's very good at doing essays, but... As someone put it, the essays are sort of uninspired. It's like someone who took the class but doesn't really care about it. Show me a conversation between Mark Twain and Joseph Stalin. And it knows enough about each one, it could predict the kind of thing they would say to each other. It's good at that sort of thing. There's a fellow named Stephen Wolfram who was a math professor, a thing called... What was it? Wolfram AI? Maybe that's his company. He made a thing. And he's combining that with ChatGPT. And it knows about Wolfram Alpha. It's called Wolfram Alpha. And you can ask it what's the distance from the Earth to the Sun in millimeters. And it'll answer that. So it knows not only how to calculate, and you can ask it very obscure math, very sophisticated math problems. It knows all that. That's his background. Well, he's a physics guy, but he's got a math background in calculus, and is rarely used math that is rarely used. It's really solid on that. And logic, I guess you could ask it. Those puzzles about I have five books on my bookshelf, and the one that's red is next to one by Christopher Robin, and it could work out that sort of thing, I'm pretty sure. So It's very strong on logic, which ChatGPT is not. So he's working on putting them together so you can get accuracy and, you know, mathematics and the BSing ability of ChatGPT all in one.
Interesting. You're going to have to send me an email about that information, but we've only got about a minute and 30 seconds here left.
Just do a Google search or go to YouTube and do a search for Wolfram, W-O-L-F-R-A-M, ChatGPT, and you'll find it.
Wolfram ChatGPT. Okay, well, I'm going to have to check that out then. All righty. So we've got about 60 seconds here left, so I want to give you a big thank you for kind of coming on and saving my ass today, because Cody's... So...
Yeah, you'll have to give us an update on the goat.
Pardon what?
You'll have to let us know how the goat... You'll have to give us an update on the goat next week.
I will let you guys know about the goaties, and I will post pictures. Okay. Have a very happy Friday evening, you guys, and thank you again for Rod coming on. You're f***ing awesome, dude. I love you. All right, have a very happy evening, guys. Catch you later.